Pacifica Network. This is Democracy Now!
Pleased to announce my decision to nominate Ambassador John Negroponte as Director of National Intelligence.
President Bush nominates John Negroponte to one of the most powerful posts in the country. We'll take a look at his record as ambassador to Honduras in the early 1980s that earned him a reputation for supporting widespread human rights abuses.
I'm not sure that his curriculum vitae, his resume, is what the 9/11 Commission had in mind when it pushed to create this very, very significant new position in the United States security system to protect U.S. security.
Then, as pressure intensifies on the University of Colorado to fire Professor Ward Churchill, we'll speak with him about the controversial comments he made after the September 11th attacks.
I'm staked out. There is not an inch of give in this, not at this level of whether I get to speak, what I say when I speak, or what the function of this institution is, all right? This institution needs to be protected from the ravages of the rabid right wing, but it has to be protected on grounds that save the institution itself.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 30 people are dead following an explosion during Friday prayers outside a Shiite mosque in southern Baghdad. Shiites are celebrating the Islamic holy month of Muharram. Saturday is the holiest day of the year for them. The day marks the death of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, in a 7th century battle for leadership of the Islamic world. Meanwhile, the Indonesian government says a pair of Indonesian journalists are missing in Iraq and may have been taken captive by uniformed gunmen. Back in the United States, President Bush has nominated John Negroponte, the current U.S. ambassador to Iraq, as the first director of national intelligence. Bush said Negroponte would be his principal advisor on intelligence issues and would have authority over the budgets of the 15 U.S. intelligence agencies. Negroponte also will have the authority to order the collection of new intelligence and information sharing between agencies. The intelligence overhaul bill that Bush signed into law in December created the new position. We'll take a close look at Negroponte's history in Honduras in the 1980s, just after headlines. A major expose by the Associated Press has revealed that an Iraqi whose corpse was photographed with grinning U.S. soldiers at Abu Ghraib died under CIA interrogation while suspended by his wrists, which had been handcuffed behind his back. The death of the prisoner, Manadel al-Jamadi, became known last year when the Abu Ghraib scandal broke. The U.S. military said back then it had been ruled a homicide, but the exact circumstances of the death were not disclosed at the time. According to the investigative documents reviewed by the AP, the prisoner died in a position known as Palestinian hanging. It's unclear whether that position, which human rights groups condemn as torture, was approved by the Bush administration for use in CIA interrogations. The Justice Department and the CIA refused to comment on the story. Al-Jamadi was one of the CIA's so-called ghost detainees at Abu Ghraib, prisoners being held secretly by the agency. His death in November 2003 became public with the release of photos of Abu Ghraib guards giving a thumbs up over his bruised and puffy-faced corpse, which had been packed in ice. According to the documents, al-Jamadi died in a prison shower room during a half hour of questioning before interrogators could extract any information. The documents consist of statements from Army prison guards to investigators with the military and the CIA's Inspector General's office. One Army guard, Sergeant Jeffrey Frost, said the prisoner's arms were stretched behind him in a way he had never been before seen. Frost told investigators he was surprised al-Jamadi's arms, quote, didn't pop out of their sockets. Frost and other guards had been summoned to reposition al-Jamadi, who an interrogator said was not cooperating. As the guards released the shackles and lowered al-Jamadi, blood gushed from his mouth, quote, as if a faucet had been turned on. This according to the interview summary. Navy SEALs apprehended al-Jamadi as a suspect October 27, 2003 bombing of Red Cross offices in Baghdad that killed 12 people. His alleged role in the bombing is unclear. According to court documents and testimony, the SEALs punched, kicked, and struck al-Jamadi with their rifles before handing him over to the CIA early on November 4th. By 7 a.m., al-Jamadi was dead. According to the documents seen by AP, al-Jamadi was brought naked below the waist to prison with a CIA interrogator and translator. A green plastic bag covered his head and plastic cuffs tightly bound his wrists. Guards dressed al-Jamadi in an orange jumpsuit, slapped on metal handcuffs, and escorted him to the shower room, a common CIA interrogation spot. There, the interrogator instructed guards to attach shackles from the prisoner's handcuffs to a barred window. That would let al-Jamadi stand without pain, but if he tried to lower himself, his arms would be stretched above and behind him. Documents don't make clear what happened after guards left. After about a half hour, the interrogator called for the guards to reposition the prisoner, who was slouching with his arms stretched behind him. The interrogator told guards that al-Jamadi was playing possum, faking it, and then watched as guards struggled to get him on his feet. But al-Jamadi was already dead. Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union has released more documents it obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, these dealing with Afghanistan. According to the documents, members of an Army Special Forces unit allegedly punched, slapped, kicked, and beat Afghan civilians in two villages southeast of the capital, Kabul, last May, prompting official complaints from two senior Army psychological operations officers who were present and said they witnessed the incidents. The incidents are detailed in internal Army criminal files that the ACLU released yesterday. They also documented other allegations of abuse in Afghanistan as recently as last year. In one strikingly similar event, the Army last year found about half a dozen photographs that depict masked U.S. soldiers standing with their weapons pointed at the heads of handcuffed and hooded or blindfolded detainees at a base in southern Afghanistan, and in one case, pressing a detainee's head against the wall of a cage where he was brought for interrogation. The photographs were found on a compact disc left in one of the unit's offices. None of the photos have been published, and an Army spokesperson said yesterday they're being withheld from release, quote, to protect the privacy of the Afghan victims. The acts photographed in Afghanistan occurred without provocation between December 2003 and February 2004 and violated Army regulations, according to testimony in the Army documents. Members of the unit said they took the pictures for sport, and also said they destroyed some images after photos appeared in the media of similar acts at the Abu Ghraib prison. The ACLU said some of the photos depicted mock executions. None of those involved in the seven new cases of alleged abuse were charged by the Army with criminal wrongdoing. Even though investigators found probable cause to charge another soldier in the unit with assault for punching a bound detainee in the back of the head, the documents don't indicate any punishment was imposed. And this news from Brazil. Thousands of soldiers have been deployed to an Amazon rainforest region where a U.S. nun was shot to death last weekend amid violent attacks by loggers and ranchers against indigenous people trying to defend the area's vast natural resources. The Brazilian president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, cut short a visit to Suriname and rushed home yesterday, where he held an emergency cabinet meeting on the situation. Yesterday, Lula ordered the creation of two massive new rainforest reserves amid increasing pressure to protect the region. About 2,000 troops were mobilized to the area to restore order hours after thousands of people converged on the small Amazon town of Anapu to bury the bullet-ridden body of Dorothy Stang, the 73-year-old nun who was killed trying to defend the jungle where she'd lived for decades. Stang is a naturalized Brazilian originally from Dayton, Ohio. She was attacked Saturday. A witness said she began to read from a Bible before being shot at close range six times by two gunmen. The government says it hopes the troops will put an end to the violence in the area where slave labor and illegal logging is rife. But environmentalists have said the soldiers alone cannot solve the region's problems. The Brazilian government recently restored some logging permits in the area after loggers and ranchers staged protests by blocking roads. In the latest attacks, assailants gunned down the former president of the Rural Workers Union. In addition, a farmer was found shot to death in an area where Stang had been trying to establish a sustainable development project for poor Brazilians. Meanwhile, the Independent Media Center in Brazil reported this week that on Wednesday, Brazilian military police raided a homeless camp, killing at least two members of the homeless movement. More than 800 people were arrested, including two indie media journalists, one of them from New York. Back in this country, the Food and Drug Administration has given the go-ahead for soldiers traumatized by their time in Iraq and Afghanistan to be offered the party drug ecstasy to help free them of flashbacks and recurring nightmares. The soldiers would take the drug as part of an experiment to see if MDMA, the active ingredient in ecstasy, can treat post-traumatic stress disorder. Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush has nominated John Negroponte, the current U.S. ambassador to Iraq, as the country's first director of national intelligence. Bush made the surprise announcement at a news conference yesterday in Washington.
I'm pleased to announce my decision to nominate Ambassador John Negroponte as director of national intelligence. The director's responsibility is straightforward and demanding. John will make sure that those whose duty it is to defend America have the information we need to make the right decisions. John understands America's global intelligence needs because he spent the better part of his life in our foreign service and is now serving with distinction in the sensitive post of our nation's first ambassador to a free Iraq. John's nomination comes at an historic moment for our intelligence services. In the war against terrorists who target innocent civilians and continue to seek weapons of mass murder, intelligence is our first line of defense. If we're going to stop the terrorists before they strike, we must ensure that our intelligence agencies work as a single, unified enterprise. And that's why I supported and Congress passed reform legislation creating the job of Director of National Intelligence.
President Bush speaking in Washington on Thursday. John Negroponte will have daily access to Bush as his primary intelligence briefer, would have authority over the budgets of the 15 U.S. intelligence agencies. He'll also have the authority to order the collection of new intelligence and information sharing between agencies. Creating the new top intelligence position was a central recommendation of the 9/11 Commission. It was included in an intelligence overhaul bill that Bush signed into law in December. Negroponte has been ambassador to Baghdad for less than a year. Democratic Senator Carl Levin of Michigan said he's concerned, quote, about the message we're sending to Iraq and the rest of the world by removing Negroponte from Baghdad so soon after he took office in June. Negroponte served as U.S. ambassador to the U.N. from 2001 to 2004, but it's his time as ambassador to Honduras from 1981 to 1985 that earned him a reputation for supporting widespread human rights abuses and campaigns of terror. Negroponte played a key role in coordinating U.S. covert aid to the Contras, who targeted civilians in Nicaragua. and shoring up a CIA-backed death squad in Honduras. During Negroponte's tenure, U.S. military aid to Honduras skyrocketed from $3.9 million to over $77 million. Much of this went to ensure the Honduran Army's loyalty in the battle against popular movements throughout Central America. The Senate must confirm Negroponte to the new post of National Intelligence Director. In his confirmation hearings as U.N. ambassador in 2001, he was asked whether he'd supported human rights abuses by death squads, which were funded and partly trained by the Central Intelligence Agency. Negroponte testified he did not believe the abuses were part of a deliberate Honduran government policy. He said, quote, "To this day, I do not believe that death squads were operating in Honduras." To talk about Negroponte's record as the ambassador to Honduras, we're joined by two guests. Sister Leticia Bordas is a Catholic nun with the Society of Helpers, a Catholic community of women. She's talking to us from San Bruno, California. And online with us from Washington, we're joined by Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst at the National Security Archive, author of The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. Peter Kornbluh, I want to begin with you. Can you lay out John Negroponte's record in the early 80s?
He was the proconsul. He essentially ran Honduras as the Reagan administration changed it from a small Central American country into a territorial battleship, if you will, to fight the Contra War and overthrow the Sandinista government. And he was really the head person in charge of this whole operation, which became a massive paramilitary war in the early 1980s.
Can you talk about Battalion 316? What was its role in Honduras, and what did the U.S. government have to do with it?
Battalion 316 was the Honduran military special forces elite unit. It certainly became a death squad, contrary to what Negroponte said. He must have been well aware that the CIA was working extremely closely with this particular unit. The U.S. Special Forces were providing extraordinary aid to this particular unit. The human rights ombudsman in Honduras, Leo Valladares, did a major investigation of the atrocities of this unit and concluded that it was mostly responsible for the murders of up to 184 people, one of them an American priest working in Honduras, Father Carney. And the CIA worked very closely with this unit, both to fight the left in Honduras and to sustain the Contra War. I should say that we have many declassified documents from the Iran-Contra scandal, which do show Negroponte's kind of odd role. He stepped out of being U.S. ambassador and kind of put on the hat of a CIA station chief in pushing for the Contras to get more arms, in lobbying and meeting with very high Honduran officials to facilitate U.S. support for the Contras and Honduran cooperation, even after the U.S. Congress terminated official support for the Contra War.
I was just watching the Senate Intelligence, head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Pat Roberts. He was being asked about, you know, the confirmation hearings for John Negroponte and asked if he has enough intelligence background. He has diplomatic background. And he said, no, he has both, because as ambassador, he is in charge of the CIA station chief. And so he always knows what's going on around intelligence in his embassy. Of course, I think he was talking about very much Iraq, but what about what Negroponte knew and when he knew it in Honduras?
Well, you know, the interesting thing, Amy, is that throughout the years, ambassadors and the State Department have complained that the CIA has been the stronger force in these smaller countries, particularly where major covert operations are going on, and that the embassy head, the ambassador, essentially gets cut out of the loop. But in the case of Honduras, it was just the reverse. In fact, the ambassador was a major player, not just in receiving information from the CIA station, but in really being the mover and shaker on CIA covert operations there. So he was very much in the loop, even though those are not the official duties. He was in the loop, and he was active in running this paramilitary war. I would say that his strongest qualifications for this post were the unofficial duties that he had as ambassador in Honduras.
We're going to break, and then when we come back, we'll continue speaking with Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive. We'll also speak with Leticia Bordes, the nun who met with John Negroponte when he was ambassador to Honduras in 1982, about the fate of dozens of nuns who had gone to Honduras. Stay with us.
Señor presidente, lo que traes en la mente es muy diferente de lo que piensa tu gente. ¿Quiénes son tu gente? Señor presidente, son los que quieren creerte y verte fuerte triunfar.
El presidente. Los Mojosos here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 300 stations around the country, on Pacifica radio stations and NPR stations, on public access TV stations and PBS stations, as well as both satellite networks on Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410, Link TV, and also on DirecTV, Channel 375. We video and audio stream at democracynow.org and are closed captioned for people who are deaf or hard of hearing. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue to look at the early record of John Negroponte, who's been nominated by President Bush to one of the highest posts of the land. It's new. It's Director of National Intelligence. We're looking at his record as ambassador to Honduras from 1981 to 1985. Our guests are Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archives and Leticia Bordes, an American nun who met John Negroponte in 1982. Can you talk about why you went to Honduras, Sister Leticia Bordes?
Yes, I went to Honduras in May of 1982 on a fact-finding delegation. As you know, Archbishop Romero had been assassinated in El Salvador in 1980, and there were quite a few members of Christian-based communities who were being picked up and disappearing in El Salvador. So a group of 32 women, by the way, these were not nuns, they were lay women, but they were members of Christian-based communities who had been followers of Archbishop Romero, had gone to Honduras to seek refuge from the repression that was taking place in El Salvador at that time. And these 32 women, also included were four children, by the way, in that group, disappeared in Honduras, and there were witnesses to their disappearance. Vans pulled up in front of the safe house where they were staying, and they were taken and never heard from again. And so this happened in April of 1981, and I went to Honduras in May of 1982 and met with John Negroponte to find out what had happened to these 32 women. And John Negroponte said very clearly that the embassy in El Salvador did not know what happened to those women, that we would need to talk to the Honduran government to find out about their fate. We went back. We did speak with the Honduran government. We had meetings there, and they referred us very clearly to our American embassy and sent us back to the American embassy and told us we would need to go through them to find out what had happened to the women. We had two meetings with John Negro Puente, the first. Then we went to the Honduran government, and then returned to John Negro Puente with the information that we had been given from the Honduran government. And again, he denied clearly the whereabouts of these women, and he was very specific in saying that the embassy in Honduras did not interfere in Honduran affairs. That was very, very clear. At the same time, we were talking to different people in Honduras, and it was clear from the people with whom we spoke that John Negro Puente was working closely with General Alvarez, who was chief of the armed forces in Honduras at that time, and he was facilitating, really, the training of Honduran soldiers in psychological warfare and sabotage and in many types of human rights violations. And by the way, the co-founder, the founder and commander of Battalion 316, who was General Discoa, had been trained at the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, which is very interesting. So we see the close connections that there was there between what was going on in Honduras and the American government.
Well, Sister Leticia Bordas, speaking of a School of the Americas, we've just been joined on the telephone by Andres Canteras. He is joining us from Chile right now. He's co-director of the film Hidden in Plain Sight, which is about the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. And he's also the person who, when John Negroponte was going through his confirmation hearings as U.S. ambassador to Iraq, stood up in the hearing room and protested. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Thanks for joining us, Andres.
Amy, it's really good to be with you, and I'm glad that you're really focusing on this very, very important issue. I not only disrupted Negroponte last year in April, but also in September of 2001 when he was having his hearing to become ambassador to the United Nations. And the reason that I stood up on both of those occasions is because I was trying to be a voice for the voiceless in Honduras. The sister of Manfredo Velázquez, whose name is Zenaida Velázquez, she was the founder of the Committee of Family Members of the Disappeared in Honduras. And she asked me to go to the hearing when Negroponte was to be confirmed to be ambassador to the United Nations and to be a presence there on his behalf. I did not plan to do anything at that time. But when Negroponte said in sworn testimony that he had never even heard of Battalion 316 until years after he left the post in Honduras, I couldn't believe this incredible lie that he was committing, and which is a crime, and I decided to risk arrest by standing up and telling him that the people of Honduras consider him to be a state terrorist. This was 2 days after September 11th, and I was whisked out of the room at that time. And then last year in April, when he was being in the hearing to be confirmed to be ambassador to Iraq, I also returned at that time because it just seems incredible that this man, who we considered to be a promoter of torture, knowing that that's what was going on in Honduras and in Central America, this is the man who, just before the Abu Ghraib scandal was breaking, He was under testimony there in the Senate, and he clearly went to Iraq, having had the experience of covering up U.S. involvement in torture in Central America. So this is a state terrorist that needs to be confronted. He needs to be accused of war crimes, and he needs to be taken to trial.
Peter Kornbluh, National Security Archive, can you elaborate on what Andres is saying?
Well, I think that Andres is absolutely correct that John Negroponte misled the Senate in his confirmation hearings about his knowledge of Battalion 316, about his knowledge of death squad activity. The CIA did report to him on various atrocities that took place. There is some evidence in a partially declassified CIA Inspector General's report about the battalion and its atrocities, and about the reporting out of the embassy by both CIA officers and diplomatic attachés there, that seems to imply that Negroponte preferred not to see honest, hard reporting going back to Washington on atrocities being committed by our very strong allies in Honduras. And people have to remember, and certainly your listeners remember better than anybody, your audience, and many others in this country, made Reagan's policy in Central America controversial, and managed to get Congress, push Congress to cut off aid to the Contras. And so any negative reporting on our main allies' activities in Honduras would have given further ammunition to the critics of Negroponte's policies, of Reagan's policies, etc. And that's why there are strong indications that he squashed this reporting. He certainly was critical to the Contra war effort. What he told the sister about not interfering in Honduran affairs is quite frankly laughable, because he was named essentially the proconsul. He essentially was a fallback to the age of gunboat diplomacy when the U.S. ambassador ran a Central American country. And in the early 80s, he was in that position in Honduras. I'm holding a declassified document, Amy, a White House document, which is from 1983, and it's a memo to the President of the United States, Ronald Reagan, and it begins, "Ambassador John Negroponte in Tegucigalpa, Honduras, has recommended that we increase the number of weapons issued to the FDN forces." The FDN, of course, was the leading Contra force and the one most strongly associated with massive human rights violations of civilians in Nicaragua. In this memo, Negroponte has apparently recommended that the United States send 3,000 additional rifles to the FDN forces, and his recommendation is approved by the president. There are two little RRs, Ronald Reagan, in the yes box under the recommendation in this options memo. So you get a sense from these declassified records of how important Negroponte was, and the type of kind of odd role he played, stepping out of his position as ambassador, a diplomat, and essentially putting on the hat of a CIA station chief in pushing forward the Contra war.
When you heard, Peter Kornbluh, that John Negroponte had been promoted yet again from UN ambassador to Iraq ambassador, now to become the director of national intelligence, what was your reaction?
Well, part of it is that this president, George Bush, has resurrected many of the Iran-Contra criminals, if you will, or people who certainly tarnished their own careers and the image of the United States by their activities in the Iran-Contra operations. And John Negroponte was certainly one of them. I thought that this was not the person that the 9/11 Commission had in mind when they wrote for the need, described the need for us to reconfigure our intelligence community and have a very, very forceful person at the top. And John Negroponte's resume is a diplomatic one, aside from his involvement in paramilitary operations in Honduras. And he has no deep background in the intelligence community, other than being a State Department official who received intelligence during the course of his positions as head of embassies in the Philippines and Honduras and Mexico at the United Nations, etc. So this was, as everybody is treating it, as somewhat of a surprise, and obviously not the first choice of the president either. We know that he went to three other people before he finally arrived under pressure at picking John Negroponte.
Apparently among them, Robert Gates, the former director of
Robert Gates, who had already been DCI, Director of Central Intelligence, apparently did not want to be DNI, Director of National Intelligence.
Hmm. Let me put that same question to Leticia Bordes, American nun who met with John Negroponte in 1982 over the fate of dozens of nuns in Honduras. Your reaction as you've watched John Negroponte's career as he moves up in the U.S. government?
Yes, when I heard the news yesterday, I must say I was devastated, absolutely devastated. I wondered, can things get any worse, really? And I am frightened for our own country. I think of what happened in Central America in countries like Honduras, like El Salvador, like Guatemala, where ordinary people organized for justice, for their basic rights. And they disappeared. And I'm wondering if that's the road that we're on now, when we hear the president saying that John Negroponte is responsible for getting the information that we need and gathering all the intelligence and, you know, stopping them before they stop us, that kind of language. It really frightens me. Sometimes I feel that we're on a roller coaster and we're headed down, and there's no one pulling the switch. And I think the switch ought to have been pulled on John Negroponte years ago when the Senate nominated him, approved his nomination to be ambassador to the UN. That was their fault. When once again they approved his nomination as ambassador to Iraq, I mean, they bear the responsibility for that. Right now, his confirmation is going to come before the Senate again. Are they going to approve this nomination? I mean, when is all this going to stop? That is what I'm asking. When is it going to stop?
If I recall correctly, Democratic Senator Dodd of Connecticut opposed the confirmation of John Negroponte as ambassador to the UN on the grounds of what he had done in Central America. But when it came to his being nominated and confirmed as U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Senator Dodd backed off the protest he had made earlier. When you heard Andres Canteras about this nomination yesterday while you're in Chile, what was your response? And do you think there will be Democrats who will raise the kinds of issues you're raising, Andres?
You know, Amy, in terms of Democratic protest, it seems like what they will probably do again is have another love fest, which was the description of the last Senate committee hearing when he was to become ambassador to Iraq. Here in Chile, they are very mindful of the role that the United States and CIA had in the coup of 1973. And as Sister Leticia is talking, it seems in some ways that our country is practically a Chile in 1972, and we are approaching more and more what could become an overt military dictatorship, with folks like Negroponte in power, with the Elliot Abrams being promoted, and all of the ones who have committed human rights crimes are the ones who are being rewarded. Those who are the most experts in what the CIA engages in constantly as plausible deniability, they are the experts in this horrendous kind of policy, and they're the ones who are really going to be pushing the buttons in terms of U.S. war-making around the world. A month ago, Amy, we heard that from Newsweek that the Salvador option was being implemented in Iraq. What we're seeing is that the U.S. military is losing the war there, and so the Salvador option was really a policy of death squads. And it's no coincidence that Negroponte, having been the ambassador in Honduras, where he was very much engaged in this kind of support for death squads, was the ambassador in Iraq, and this is the kind of policy that was starting to be implemented there, which is not just going after the resistance itself, but targeting for repression and torture and assassination the underlying support base, the family members, and those in the communities that where the resistance is. These kinds of policies are war crimes, and these officials need to be called to accountability.
I want to thank you all for being with us. Andre Canteras, if people want to find out about your film, Hidden in Plain Sight, where do they go on the web?
Thank you, Amy. They would go to www.hiddeninplainsight.org. We are going to be screening the film here in Chile tonight. We screened it at the World Social Forum in Brazil, and I've been traveling here in the Southern Cone of Latin America talking about the role of the School of the Americas and U.S. support for torture.
And Peter Kornbluh, National Security Archive. If people want to see the documents that the National Security Archive has on this period, where can they go?
Well, the National Security Archive has a very prominent website, nsarchive.org. The key documents on Negroponte are not up on the site at the moment, but they are in our collections, our Iran-Contra collection. There is some citations to them and use of them in our book, The Iran-Contra Scandal, The Declassified History. And I'm sure they will be circulating around. And if there are any Democratic senators who wish to address Negroponte's role in Honduras during the questioning for confirmation of this post, they certainly will have these documents in their hands.
And maybe even Republican senators as well.
I would doubt there are going to be very many of those who are going to challenge this nomination, Amy. But
well,
hopefully you're right, and there might be a few.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us, as well as Sister Letitia Bordis, who is the Catholic nun with the Society of Helpers, the Catholic community of women, speaking from San Bruno, California. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Native Flute Ensemble here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to a controversy at the University of Colorado that's captured national headlines and sparked debate about academic freedom, free speech on college campuses nationwide. At the center of the controversy is Ward Churchill, professor of Ethnic Studies Department at the University of Colorado, Boulder. Professor Churchill is a well-known activist with the American Indian Movement, author of a number of books on genocide against indigenous people and the U.S. government's COINTEL program. The current controversy began in February with an article published on the front page of the Hamilton College newspaper, The Spectator. The college, which is located upstate New York, had invited Professor Churchill to speak at the school at the beginning of February. The article highlighted statements Professor Churchill made in an essay about the September 11th attacks. The essay was called "Some People Push Back on the Justice of Roosting Chickens." Among other things, the article said many of the people killed in the Pentagon and the World Trade Center attacks on 9/11 were not innocent civilians. The passage that received the most attention was Churchill's labeling of the people described as a, quote, technocratic core at the very heart of America's global financial empire as, quote, little Eichmanns. After the article in the school newspaper was published, some Hamilton professors began to call for the college to rescind Professor Churchill's invitation. Others defended his right to free speech. The controversy quickly spread outside Hamilton College, with Bill O'Reilly of Fox News repeatedly attacking Churchill on his TV program as late as last night. On February 1st, Colorado Governor Bill Owens wrote a letter to the university calling for Churchill's resignation. Governor Owens also made the same call on the O'Reilly factor.
But this is such an embarrassment for your state, which is a changing state, but it's a traditional state. And this guy's embarrassed Colorado from Trinidad up to Greeley.
Absolutely.
And over to, Steamboat Springs. Everybody's
You've been here.
Yeah, they're like appalled.
It is embarrassing.
How can this happen?
And that's why we're trying to deal with it. Now, obviously, you know tenure laws and you know the First Amendment, and we respect the law and we respect the First Amendment. So we're trying to address this, and the regents are, by going through that rule of law process to make sure that when they make the decision, and I'm hoping it's to terminate him, that they can have it withstand court scrutiny. But how far have we gone in this country that you're able to call for more murder, call for more 9/11, say that the United States should cease to exist, and that we sit around and we're going to have to spend probably several years going through a process so that this guy can't speak as a professor of the University of Colorado.
And he's also making $100,000 or close to it. Of taxpayer money. One more thing. I'm revising my opinion based upon this new information that he thinks more 9/11s are necessary. But last week I said, look, don't fire him, because the message it sends to our enemies is we oppress people we disagree with. Our country's strong enough to put up with even him. But now he seems to have gone over another line. You know, if he's calling for the murder of American citizens, you simply can't have him.
That was Bill O'Reilly and Colorado Governor Bill Owens on the O'Reilly Factor February 7th. That same week, the University of Colorado Board of Regents voted to review all of Churchill's speeches and writings in order to determine whether there's cause for his dismissal. And 2 days before Churchill was scheduled to speak, Hamilton College withdrew the invitation, citing security concerns. Interestingly, the panel that Hamilton had originally asked Professor Churchill to be on was titled The Limits of Dissent. We turn now to Professor Ward Churchill, joining us from Boulder, Colorado. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you respond to this firestorm now? But I'd like you to start off by you explaining your comments that have become well-known now around the issue of the technocrats at the World Trade Center being like little Eichmanns.
Well, it goes to Hannah Arendt's notion of Eichmann, thesis that he embodied the banality of evil, that she had gone to the Eichmann trial to confront the epitome of evil in her mind and expected to encounter something monstrous, and what she encountered instead was this nondescript little man, a bureaucrat, a technocrat, a guy who arranged train schedules, who, as it turned out, ultimately didn't even agree with the policy that he was implementing, but performed the technical functions that made the Holocaust possible, at least in the efficient manner that it occurred, in a totally amoral and soulless way, purely on the basis of excelling at the function and getting ahead within the system that he found himself, who was a good family man in his way, was loved by his children, participated in civic activities, was, in essence, the good German. And she said, therein lies the evil. It wasn't that Eichmann was a Nazi or a high official within Nazism, although he was, in fact, a Nazi and a relatively highly placed official, but it was exactly the reverse, that given his actual nomenclature, the actuality of Eichmann was that anyone in this sort of mindless, faceless, bureaucratic capacity could be the Nazi, that he was every man. And that was what was truly horrifying to her in the end. And that was a controversial thesis, because there's always this effort to distinguish anyone and everyone, irrespective of what they're doing, from this polarity of evil that signified in Nazism, and she had breached the wall and brought the lessons of how Nazism actually functioned, the modernity of it, home and visited upon everyone, calling for then personal accountability, responsibility, taking of responsibility for the outcome of the performance of one's functions. And that's exactly what it is that is shirked here and makes it possible for people to, from a safe remove, perform technical functions that result, and at some level they know this, they understand it, in carnage, immiseration, the death of millions ultimately. That's the Eichmann aspect. But note I said little Eichmanns, not the big Eichmann, not the real Eichmann. The real Eichmann ultimately is symbolic. He was symbolic even in his own context. He symbolized the people that worked under him. He symbolized the people who actually were on the trains that were hauling the Jews. He symbolized the technicians who were making the gas for A.G. Farben. He symbolized all of these people who didn't directly kill anybody, but performed functions and performed those functions with a certain degree of enthusiasm and certainly with a great degree of efficiency that had the outcome of the mass murder of the people targeted for elimination or accepted as collateral damage. That's the term of the art put forth by the Pentagon.
How many people have interpreted this? If, as you said, true enough, they were civilians of a sort, but innocent, give me a break. They formed a technocratic core at the very heart of America's global financial empire, the mighty engine of profit to which the military dimension of U.S. policy has always been enslaved, and they did so both willingly and knowingly. How many people have interpreted this as that they deserve what they got?
Well, I'm not a judge. I don't make the assessment as to what it is they deserve. I'm simply pointing to the reality of it. I don't know that I even agreed with the execution of Eichmann, per se. I'm not repudiating it. I'm not taking exception to it and defending the man, but I don't make that decision. What I did was posit the reality with the intent of allowing the reader, or compelling the reader even, to draw their own conclusion. That if their conclusion is that if you do these things, you deserve death, then that's the conclusion they've drawn.
What conclusion have you drawn about September 11th? And
well, I posit my conclusions that if you want to avoid September 11th, if you want security in some actual form, then it's almost a biblical framing. You have to do unto others as you would have them do unto you, and as long as you're doing what the U.S. is doing in the world, you can anticipate a natural and inevitable response of the sort that occurred on 9-1-1. And if you don't get the message out of 9-1-1, that you're going to have to change, first of all, your perception of the value of those others who are consigned to domains, semantic domains like collateral damage, then you've really got no complaint when the rules you've imposed come back on you. If you're going to alter that scenario, you first have to value those little brown bodies that are embodied in the Iraqi children, the 500,000 that were mentioned first, or the Palestinians, or the Grenadians, or the Guatemalans, or the Nicaraguans, or you take off the list, you're going to have to treat them as having human faces, actually having human value, and not something, some form of existence to be slaughtered with impunity. And the best signification of that, since rhetorically at least, the U.S. has always postured itself at the forefront of valuing others, even as it treats them like toilet paper. Rhetoric alone is not going to do it. Ennobling rhetoric is absolutely irrelevant in this context. You're going to have to do something concrete. And I recommended the most concrete thing that could be done was an overt and tangible manifestation of the U.S. at the highest policymaking levels, as demanded by the general citizenry, to begin to adhere to the rule of law. That is, announced that it accepts the idea that the U.S. is bound to conform to international legal requirements the same as any other country, rather than announcing always and inevitably that it was entitled to some sort of a self-defined exception from the rule, and that when other people or other peoples objected to that, a unilateralist policy.
Professor Churchill, do you think that the World Trade Center was an acceptable target on September 11th? Do you think it was a legitimate target?
Do I personally think it
yes.
was a legitimate target or should have been a legitimate target? Absolutely not. And that's said on the basis of all but absolute rejection of and opposition to U.S. policy. But what you have to understand, and what the listeners have to understand, is that under U.S. rules, it was an acceptable target. And the reason it was an acceptable target, if none other, was that because the CIA, the Defense Department, and other parts of the U.S. military intelligence infrastructure had situated offices within it. And you'll recall that that is precisely the justification advanced by the Donald Rumsfelds of the world, the Norman Schwarzkopfs, and the Colin Powells of the world to explain why civilian targets have been bombed in Baghdad, because that nefarious Saddam Hussein had situated elements of his command and control infrastructure within otherwise civilian-occupied facilities. And they said that in itself justified their bombing the civilian facilities in order to eliminate the parts of the command and control infrastructure that were situated there. And, of course, that then became Saddam Hussein's fault. Well, if it was Saddam Hussein's fault, sacrificing his own people by encapsulating strategic targets within civilian facilities, the same rule would apply to the United States. So if you got a complaint out there with regard to the people who hit the World Trade Center, you should actually take it to the government of the United States, which by the rubric they apply elsewhere in the world, everywhere else in the world, ultimately, they converted them from civilian targets into legitimate military targets. Now, that logic is there, and it's unassailable. It's not something I embrace. It's something I just spell out.
What are you saying was in the World Trade Center?
There was a Central Intelligence Agency office. There were Defense Department offices. There was, I believe, an FBI facility, all of which fit the criteria of bombing target selection utilized by the Pentagon.
We're talking
to... If it's fair to bomb such targets in Baghdad, it would be fair for others to bomb such targets in New York. That's what I'm saying. I don't think it's fair to bomb such targets in Baghdad, therefore I could reject New York, but so long as the United States is applying those rules out in the world, it really has no complaint when those rules are applied to it.
Professor Churchill, why did you resign as head of the Department of Ethnic Studies? You were the chairperson, and what are you planning to do right now? Just hearing that at Eastern Washington University, the faculty voted unanimously, one abstention, voted unanimously to reverse the university's decision and reinvite you for an engagement you already had there. But this whole investigation that's going on at the University of Colorado, why did you resign, and what are you planning to do next?
Well, I resigned immediately when this became an issue because, rightly or wrongly, there's certain connotation to being an administrative representative of the institution, and that was unfair, but it also encumbered my time in ways that would be unfair of my colleagues if I did not fulfill my responsibilities in an administrative capacity, and I needed my time available to fight this particular fight. So I cleared the decks for action is what that really came down to. I didn't want the diversion into a false symbology of what it was that I represented in making my statements and asserting my rights on the one hand, and I needed my time available to do what it is that I'm doing now, which is not exactly what I intended to do in the first place, but again, these are the rules that have been imposed upon me, so I'll meet them on the terms that are imposed.
And what are your plans right now? I mean, you have the governor calling for your resignation or firing. You've got the university investigating you.
Well, the university can investigate to its heart's content, but this is ultimately a sort of absurdity. The things they're purportedly investigating have already been vetted. I'll stand on my work, on my scholarship, and on my record. No issue there at all. If they want to review their own reviews and see if that's, I didn't warrant the sort of station that I now occupy based upon their own assessments and the assessments of third-party scholars, experts in the fields over a 20-year period, then they can squander the taxpayers' money doing that. The fact of the matter is, however, this is a considerable expenditure of tax monies to reaffirm what has already been affirmed. Meanwhile, the governor's howling about the tax money that goes into subsidizing my salary, and overall in the institutional profile, the tax dollars, the taxpayer contribution, largely is a result of his own and the Colorado legislature's own Republican desire to remove taxpayers' money from funding things like higher education.
Professor Churchill,
about 7% of the whole.
We have to leave it there. I thank you. That does it for today's broadcast. Jeremy Scaho, Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Hress, John Hamilton, Yoruba Richin produced today's show. Thanks to Dennis Moynihan. DemocracyNow.org is our website. I'm Amy Goodman.